This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Unless you're a designer, you might not think about fonts very much. Yeah, you might have to if you're stuck doing the company newsletter. But if you stop and really look around you, typography of all kinds surrounds us every day. It creates a visual fabric for our lives and for our language. Today, Where We Live, we'll continue a little mini-series we've had on design with a conversation about typography. What's the role of fonts in your life? Do you have a favorite one for different purposes? Have you ever thought about what goes into the creation of a typeface? We'll look at what we can learn about Connecticut's own sense of identity from its signage. Is there an iconic sign that for you really defines a particular place in the state? Now, we have some designers in studio, including Alexander Isley here with us in Hartford. Nikki Villagomez joins us from Cleveland. We also have some letterpress artists with us in studio who are contributing to an identity for Hartford and beyond for the entire state. But first, let's define typography. Designer Massimo Vignelli in the film Helvetica says it's not so much about just the ink on the page.
Good typographer always had sensitivity about the distance between letters. We think typography is black on white. Typography is really white. You know, it's not even black. It is the space between the blacks that really makes it. In a sense, it's like music. It's not the notes. It's the space you put between the notes that makes the music.
That's a very deep thought on typography. If they can make an entire film out of Helvetica, we can make a show out of typography here on Where We Live. You can join us 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. I talk about the role of fonts in your life and typeface in your life. Maybe you can even send us some pictures of signs that are some of your favorites from around the state. We'll be talking about that in just a little bit. But I want to welcome in Nikki Villagomez, who's senior designer, Dixon Hughes Goodman in Hudson, Ohio. She joins us from the studios of WCPN, the Idea Center in Cleveland, Ohio today. She's going to be speaking about this subject Thursday night at the Grove in New Haven starting at 6 p.m. Nikki, welcome to our show.
Thanks for having me.
So maybe you can define typography for me in your words, in your mind.
Type is just the letters on a page, what we see, as simple as that. Like the quote you just played from the movie Helvetica, it's just positive and negative shapes that is communication.
It's communication. Is it something that you think that as a society we pay not enough attention to? Because clearly it is everywhere, but a lot of people probably go about their everyday lives without thinking about it very much at all.
Yeah, that's very true. I think especially for people who are born and raised in the city they live in, it just becomes second nature. And like the pictures hanging on the walls of your house, you just don't see them anymore. You know, you see it, but you don't see it. And that's why going on vacation is so much fun, is it forces you to look at the typography and the different designs and the food and everything so differently.
And we'll be talking about some of that sense of place and some of the work that you do in just a bit. Alexander Isley is here, designer and owner of Alexander Isley Incorporated, based in Reading, Connecticut. Thanks for coming in, Alex. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
So maybe you can give me a definition. What does it mean to you?
Typography?
Yeah.
Well, typography is the way that words and letters are assembled on a page or on a sign or on a building to convey some sort of spirit. It's more than just communicating information. If it's done really well, it can suggest a sensibility or somehow provide a spirit behind what has been written.
So I guess I'm wondering if you could maybe give us a little bit of a background on how we got to the typography that we have today. I mean, it wasn't all done with computers, and it wasn't just from a drop-down list on your machine. You used to actually have to make these things by hand. We're going to be talking to some people who actually still press letters themselves. But maybe you can talk a bit about the history of typography, where it all comes from.
Sure. Well, typography, as we now know it, was really originated back in the 1400s when Gutenberg started using movable type or movable letters to create something that could be reproduced. And over the centuries, the technology has changed from hot metal type to wood type to phototype. These are all kind of things that were done by more or less professionals or people that were schooled in how to do this. And within the last 30 years, with the advent of computers, type and typography has become something that is much more familiar to people. So it's been a real change, because before you didn't really need to know about how things were made. But now I speak with people all over the place and they know about fonts and they misuse terms all the time. But now it's everyone's fingertips. And so people are a lot more aware of type and typography where they weren't a generation ago.
Alexander, how do you use it as a designer? Give me some examples of how you use typography on a daily basis.
Well, almost everything that we design, we're communication designers, we design signage, words are important. And I think that it's important to think about how they're going to be perceived by people. And a lot of what we design is based on text and has really heavy use on words. So you really need to consider those carefully. And I think if you do a good job, you can use words and letters almost as illustration. They can serve a purpose to really get people to respond to things and look at them. And I think as a designer, the biggest mistake you can make is just to create and treat content and text as an element on a page, and that's it. And if you start to respect what's being said and understand it, you as a designer can convey that to people, and it can be a very effective way of communicating.
Nikki, tell me about you. In your world and work as a designer, how do you use typography? Give me some examples.
Well, with my professional line of work, it's extremely important to communicate the deliverables that are the consultants I work with. They give me a slew of words, and it's my job to take those words and simplify them or apply hierarchy to them and to choose a typeface that best communicates what they're trying to communicate to our clients. So in my professional world at Dixon Hughes Goodman with Healthcare Consulting, it's extremely important to choose the right typeface and how it's laid out on a page. But with my blog, which has kind of taken over a life of its own, I've just become a lot more aware of the typography that's around me wherever I go.
I want to get to the phones. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. Carl's calling from Avon. Hi, Carl. Go ahead.
Yes, I have a comment about large print, like, I don't know, 12, 14-point type. And I have a Bible that's four volumes thick, and it has very large print. And I find it very helpful in reading such large print. And I also heard that people who have a hard time wanting to read have been improved by reading in anything in very large print, and it helps them to really be successful in learning to read. I also enjoy brush type, and I have a question on quotation marks, but that's a little tiny point.
You have a question about quotation marks. Okay, give us your question.
Well, the question, the way the tail is put on a question mark. I used to be a printer once upon a time. I know the California job case quite well. That was 50 years ago. But anyway, the quotation marks have the bold point up on top, and then they circle down. But that's at the end of the word. At the beginning of the word, it used to be the big point was at the top, and then it curled down. But I've seen it now the opposite way, and I kind of question that understanding.
Let's get some answers from our next guest. Addie Gale and Rory Gale are here. They're designers and owners of Hartford Prints, a letterpress studio owned by three sisters. Two of the sisters are here with us today. The third one just had a baby. Congratulations to the family, and welcome to you both.
Thank you.
I saw you nodding your head in his question about this.
Well, I have no real answer, and I'm by no means an expert on these things, but it is true that you used to see it that the quotation marks were the same. They went the same in both directions, and now they're used in more like parentheses with an opening and a close. And I have no idea who made that change, why it happened, but visually I appreciate that the change was made, because it really, like parentheses, like the ellipse, it contains what you're saying better, and it really gives a sense of this is the quote that you're making. This is someone talking now in a text. So I have no real answer there, unfortunately. But
well, I want to hear a good move. I want to hear a little bit from the two of you about how you got into this business, and explain exactly what it is the business you do is, because again, people think that you print now with a printer, right? You get an ink cartridge and you put it in and you pick out a font and then you just print out whatever papers you need. That's
right.
Not what you guys do.
No. No. So what we do is basically the modern version of Gutenberg. We have movable type, and we can print from that, or we can, with modern technologies, we can get plates made now, photopolymer plates. And so you can design anything on a computer and then print it. So I studied book arts and printmaking as a graduate student at the University of the Arts in Philadelphia, and learned letterpress there. I had some prior experience to it, but that's really where my main exposure came. And I then ended up teaching it. And so for me, typography is the my art form. It's my medium that I use, and I don't use text so much as an artist to convey any great message. I use it as a pictorial. It functions as image for me, text as image versus text that's meant to be read. You certainly can read my type. You can read whatever I'm doing, but it's really meant to be the overall image. But Rory and I got into business together because I had started this letterpress studio here in Hartford through a grant from the administered by the Greater Hartford Arts Council in 2009. And I was working with high school students, and the grant money was running out. And Rory came to me and said, hey, I think we could really go into business together because Rory has a background that maybe she can talk about.
Yeah, tell us about your background.
Well, I just always got a kick out of typography and graphic design and played around with it on my own and helped design both my sister's wedding invitations. So then when Addie, the grant money was running out and we were looking for something, the next move, it sort of made sense. We have this equipment. We have this talent. Let's put it to use. So now we're printing wedding invitations, business cards, stationery, but we also are giving a voice to Hartford and Connecticut and sort of trying to brand our state and our city with a really cool identity.
And I want to talk more about branding the state and the city through that cool identity in just a little bit. We want to get to some calls, 860-275-7266, as we introduce the idea of typography in our lives and how it surrounds us every single day. If you want to join us, again, 860-275-7266. Lang is calling from Stratford. Hi, Lang.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I think it's really interesting that you're having this conversation and that you're curious to know, you know, what typography means to you, because my father was a typeface designer. He's a consultant now, and we've always considered it an art. We display things like old wooden letterpresses in our house, like they're art, and old marquee signs, and I've always seen it as an art form. Somebody designed that. Somebody sat down and figured out what each letter was going to look like, and I've always considered my father an artist, and I see it a lot more in home design nowadays, and I think it's really great that people are starting to recognize that it is an art. It's more than just a letter on a page.
Lang, thank you so much for that. I appreciate it. I want to get to Adam, too, who's calling from Milford. Hi, Adam. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'd like to bring up another form of typography that has not been brought up. Being a graffiti artist myself, I see typography everywhere, and I create it on a daily basis. Now, graffiti, I think, also pushes typography to another level. I'd like to hear your panel's thoughts on that.
Well, thank you very much, first of all, and that's one of the many things we wanted to talk about. Nikki Villagomez, you're there in Cleveland, and one of the things you take a look at is signage and how typography in public spaces helps to reflect a community. I suppose there can be no better example than the graffiti artists in a specific town, right?
Oh, that's absolutely right. I consider graffiti part of hand lettering, which is different than typography. And yes, it is absolutely an art form in itself. I found beautiful examples of graffiti when I was in Atlanta, you know, under trains and bridges and things like that. But it's just a beautiful form of expression, and it's sad that some people look down on it or want to cover it up. But I think it just kind of brings a city to life when it's done well.
Of course, one of the interesting things about public typography is that certain fonts, certain design styles try to mimic that of the brush stroke or of the graffiti artist. This is something that has been tried to be mechanized. How do you think that a lot of these attempts, Nikki Villagomez, actually work? Do you think that the machine can produce something that works as well as the hand?
Well, a machine can produce anything that it's created to produce, but I don't think anything can take the place of the uniqueness of hand lettering.
Addie, how about you? I mean, when you're typesetting, I know that there are a number of different fonts, type styles that try to mimic the human hand in various ways. How do you use that in your work? Because it says something different when you're saying there's a human element to this as opposed to just the industrial element of a clearly mechanized process.
Yeah. Well, originally typography and fonts were meant to replicate manuscript hand lettering. You know, the Bibles were all scribed by monks, and the original typefaces were meant to mimic that and to try to replicate it as best as possible and make a book cheaper for someone to buy. And then as times changed and as the printed word became more prevalent, designers began to realize that the typefaces needed to evolve in order to keep up with how people read and what we look at. And so it's easier to have a serif font in a huge chunk of text. You know, if reading a book, you use a serif, but on signage, you often use a sans serif because it's easier to look at on the large scale.
Explain for people what serifs are.
Okay, so serifs are the little feet at the tops and bottoms of the letter, so the letter D might have a little edge to it before it begins. Is there a better way to describe it?
That's pretty much feet.
Feet.
And I think when you see blocks of text together at a smaller size, the serifs help the eye connect the individual letter forms, because I think that's an important part that needs to be brought up. Is when it's more than just designing individual beautiful letters. A good typographer thinks of the overall look or color of how the words all fit together in a harmonious way. And that gets back to the earlier comment about punctuation and quote marks. If you think of them, how they fit within a continuum of how you read, it all kind of comes together. And that's where the art of the typographer comes into play.
But you make an important distinction here. The idea of reading large blocks of text is something that's very, very different than one large word printed across the top of a building.
Yeah.
You're trying to convey something very, very different, and so you would theoretically, Alexander, use a much different typeface in order to convey those things, perhaps.
You can, and I think depends on – you have to think about who the audience is, what you're trying to communicate, how it needs to be seen. So you can have – if it's just one big honking word on the top of a building, that's much different than a 12-point type within the context of a book or on a highway sign when you're speeding down 65 miles an hour and you didn't know where your exit is. Those are all different things. And when people don't take those into account or if they haven't really thought about them, yeah, it's easy to sort of sit behind your keyboard and start plopping some type down and trying to pick something that looks pretty. But you need to consider a lot more than just that.
And we'll be talking about signs and corporate identity as well in just a little bit. A lot of people want to know about the new Yahoo logo, and we're going to get some takes from our panelists. Let's quickly go to Virginia, who's calling from Greenwich. Hi, Virginia.
Hi. I'm interested in the associations with different fonts. I had to upload a dissertation, and it was going to be read online, and I agonized over what font to use. And I first looked at Courier because somebody had told me that in the studies that Courier was convincing and honest and that people gave more money if you typed something in Courier, hysterically. And then I looked at Times New Roman because that seemed to be the fallback font for most dissertations, but it has patriarchal associations with the London Times, where I guess it originated. And I looked at Garamond, but that's Apple's font. I looked at Futura Light, but it was sans serif, and Calvin Klein uses that. I looked at Georgia, but that's a recent font, and my dissertation was about something from a long time ago. So I chose Cambria because it was older, and it seems to be much easier to read on a computer screen, and I bet that's going to be more important as time goes on. But I wondered if you could give us some more ideas about different associations and feelings and corporate identities.
It's so interesting you bring that up. One of the things I wanted to ask you, Alexander, is this idea of what the most trusted font is that's actually been studied. What's the one you can trust the most?
I think there have been a few different studies. I remember reading a recent one, which I think they said that Baskerville was the most trusted font, and I think it's completely subjective. However, if it looks sort of not too offensive and kind of familiar to people, I think people don't always know what they like, but they like what they know. And I think within different cultures, people probably ascribe trust to different types of typefaces, but that's – I can't speak to it past that other than someone did a vote and they said, oh, that looks like it's trustworthy.
We had read that Garamond was the most trustworthy font.
Oh, maybe it was Garamond.
Is this possible?
I wouldn't know about trust, but I mean, these are classic.
Yeah.
These are classic. To me, you can't go wrong with Times New Roman. If you're agonizing over something, just Times New Roman, Baskerville, Garamond, yeah, any of those is fine. The hated Comic Sans.
Oh no!
Yeah. Or Papyrus.
Or Papyrus. Yeah.
Well, but why do people hate it so much? In your line of work, the whole idea of Comic Sans, it's indeed comedy. Why would you ever?
Really good comic strips about how bad Comic Sans is. I think it's because what happened was it was one of the first ones available on a computer that didn't look the way an average font looks. You know, it was new. It was different. It looked like handwriting a little bit. It was meant to mimic that a little bit because it was mimicking the comic books, the people who would hand letter comics at the time. And so people started using it all the time for, you know, signage in bathrooms and saying, hey, don't eat my lunch, taped to a refrigerator. And it just showed up everywhere. And so yeah. I think designers started to be like, overused.
I don't trust a store or restaurant that uses papyrus.
Well, but it's not just that font, though. It's not just that particular one. To me, it's this idea that you haven't tried very hard at whatever you've done. If you pick something that is so obviously off the shelf to depict your restaurant, Alexander, I don't want to go there because I feel like you haven't put enough thought into your sign. Why on earth would I want to eat your food?
I think it came about because there weren't a lot of selections on someone's default PC, and Comic Sans was one of the ones that had like a different character, so people used it. I mean, there's a lot of hate for Comic Sans. I don't really have the passion about hating it. To me, it's just kind of a curious choice, but there are millions of horrible typefaces out there, but Comic Sans never did anything to me. But
Nikki, do you have a least favorite?
I'd say curls. I think not to stereotype, but being from the South, I'm from South Carolina, there's just a lot of curls, like the first letter of people's names, like on the back of cars, or you see it monogrammed on clothes, and it's just painful. And the fact that it's spelled C-U-R-L-Z, curls.
One of the truisms of life is that if anything ends in a Z, probably it's not that terribly trustworthy. We're talking right. today with designers who are involved, as we all are, in the world of typography and text. We're talking with Alexander Isley, Nikki Villagomez, Rory, and Addie Gale. And we're going to take some more of your calls when we come back from our break. 860-275-7266. We'll talk about some of your favorite signs as well. Do you have favorite old signs here in Connecticut, perhaps, that mean something to you? We'll leave you with a tweet from Emily. It says, lawyers are notoriously terrible with typography. Example, Connecticut appellate briefs must only be in Arial or Courier. Ugh. You can join us with a tweet at Where We Live as well. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today we're talking about typography with some designers. Our guest Nikki Villagomez is giving a talk about typography and culture on Thursday this week at The Grove in New Haven. She's interested in signs in particular, reflecting a sense of place. Have you seen some great signs, old or new, in Connecticut that you think make a statement about where we live, anything historic or modern? You can join us at 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. One of our favorites in Hartford is the ghosted advertisement on the side of the Red Rock Tavern in Frog Hollow. It's how the building gets its name now, because it sponsored an old Red Rock beverage. Nikki, tell us a bit about your blog and about how signs do reflect the place where you find them.
Well, my blog, I started it about 2 years ago, a little over 2 years ago, and my goal is just to compare side-by-side comparisons of, for example, a hotel sign in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, to a hotel sign in Melbourne, Australia, and just how the cultural, our cultural influences, the decision processes we make, whether it's intuitive or not. And that's basically my blog summed up in a short sentence there.
So, but maybe you can talk more about that. I mean, in our world today, it seems as though everyone has access to all the same images and ideas all over the place. And so there might be a bit of a standardization. But especially in old signs, you find that there are regional characteristics. There are definite things that you would only see on the outdoors of buildings in the Southwest or the Southeast or the Northeast, and you wouldn't see them anyplace else.
That's right. When I was in San Antonio, I was taken aback at how many rustic signs there were. There were a lot of earth colors used. And here in Cleveland, there's a lot of stainless steel on brick. That seems to be a very common theme here. In Atlanta, I saw a lot of graffiti, more so than any other city. In New York, a lot of the signs are vertical because of the lack of space. and then Las Vegas, you've got the massive bright lights. So, you know, any of those signs in Las Vegas would look ridiculous in downtown Sioux Falls, South Dakota, but it just totally fits in downtown Las Vegas.
And there's something so amazing about a neon sign. I know you show a lot of neon on your blog. No matter where it is, it seems to, especially if it's in a small town without a lot of neon, it just, it pops out and it makes you feel as though it's someplace, I don't know, you want to go into.
Absolutely. It just conveys a very, I don't know if it's comforting is the right word, but it just is like somebody cares. Some, you're going to get soul food if it's a drive-in with a neon sign or something like that.
I know, Alexander, you do architectural signage. This is something that you work on. Maybe you can talk about signs and how you think about them when you see whether it's an old sign or a new sign in a place. Does it help to tell a story about that particular location or maybe about the town that it's in, do you think?
It can, especially if it's a real old sign and it's authentic. But it's very easy to, if you're not careful, sort of co-opt what was historical and do it sort of fake historical. And if you're not careful, you can sort of put a history that wasn't there. And that's one reason I'm interested to hear what Nikki's going to say about Connecticut when she comes, because her blog's really interesting. And I've lived in Connecticut for almost 18 years, and I love it here. But Connecticut's a weird state in terms of,
yes, it is.
You know, a lot of reasons. But, you know, this is coming from a place of love, though. But, you know, but if you think about California architectural or signage or graphics, Florida, New York, Las Vegas, things pop to mind. Texas, immediately something comes to mind. You kind of know what you're talking about. You say Connecticut, I'm hard-pressed to find out what that sort of visual vernacular of Connecticut is, unless you sort of think back to the industrial age, you know, Remington Arms factories or Colt or typewriter factories, manufacturing, you know, from the eight. But what's happened since the 1860s? I don't know. So maybe some of the readers can come in and tell me, or listeners, all the things that I'm missing. But I've had a hard time trying to sort of think about what contemporary environmental signage graphics are within Connecticut, because a lot of it's very transitory, or I just haven't come across the parts that are historical. But so help me out. I'm kind of at a loss.
And we'd love to hear from you at 860-275-7266. Is there a sign in and around Connecticut that tells a bit of the story of the place? Nikki, I know you've been looking at Connecticut. Do you face the same problem that Alexander does? I mean, do you find anything yet that tells the story of Connecticut?
It's hard for me to summarize it right now because I asked the local AIGA chapter who is bringing me in, the American Institute of Graphic Arts, the Connecticut chapter, to send me pictures that are specific to the Connecticut area. So out of, you know, 40 people to send me pictures, it's hard for me to make a generic statement about the state of Connecticut.
Yeah, and it's hard for us sometimes to make a generic statement about the state of Connecticut after living here for a long time. And so Rory, this is one of the things that you're working on, though, trying to find a visual identity for the state. Tell us about what your work has been.
Well, it's similar to what we've been talking about. You know, New York, I love New York shirts. Like every state, Philadelphia, all these cities and states have identities. And for Connecticut, we get lost. We're in between New York and Boston. You know, people don't have ways to say, you know, I actually like where I live and I want to wear it or write about it.
I think sometimes the perception of Connecticut, when you talk to someone from outside of New England, they think of Connecticut as quintessential New England town. Oh, it's all farmhouses and quaint little white churches. And we're like, actually, no. Like, have you seen Waterbury, Hartford, Bridgeport, New Haven? It's really not that. So to change that a little bit.
But I think that's one of the things, and Alexander, you brought this up, this idea that a place can almost foist upon itself an identity that was never there to begin with. I mean, we've talked on this show at quite some length, I might add, about the still revolutionary moniker that the state decided to put on itself for its tourism. And when you decide to cast yourself back to revolutionary times, it has, in my mind, something along with typeface and colors and everything else that is going to depict a kind of colonial America that maybe isn't really what we're all about. It's telling ourselves that we're something we're not.
Yeah, I think that's still revolutionary. I'm glad you brought that up, because actually the Visitors and Tourism Bureau, I think, has an RFP out right now for ad agencies to market and promote Connecticut, you know, but the deal is you have to work with that still revolutionary. And I think that's a difficult thing because to me it's more than a whiff defensive. First of all, it's like, yeah, stuff here's happened since 1750, you know. And the fact that you have to, it's almost like you're on the rope swinging trying to like come up with something. So I kind of question that because, you know, can we think of anything more positive or more, you know, rather than hearkening to the past, which is important in any place in the country, talk about what's vital and important now.
Well, and honestly, if they'd asked the ladies from Hartford Prince about this beforehand, maybe they would have come up with something. You're wearing a shirt right now, Rory, that has the typeface, but it also has a slogan. Maybe you can just tell us about what you've come up with here.
Yeah, well, we were looking for, you know, that identity for Connecticut. And we came up with the slogan, Small State, Big Heart, because, you know, we are a small state. You know, Rhode Island has a sort of gotten a little angry that we're calling ourselves that. And then the heart is for Hartford. So we came up with this slogan and then made a card out of it. And then it really took off. So we made the T-shirt.
And you made the T-shirt. And your T-shirt actually has, and this is something that happens all the time, it has a representation of Connecticut. Because Connecticut has this unusual shape, you're actually able to use the shape of Connecticut in this design in a way that, and I'll just say, you know, Rhode Island, they can shut up. They're a small state. They're a very small state, but their state doesn't look very cool. It's a strange-looking thing. Connecticut's it has an interesting look to it, and it actually shows up in the font that you've chosen as well. I mean, to tell us a little bit more about what went into this and this other design, the Live Local, Love Hartford design.
So we were just looking for a cool way to represent our state and have it be subtle but have a strong messaging. So I think the slogan itself was really what we were working with. So Small State, Big Heart, that like spoke to people, and then using the imagery of the state and then tying into the heart around Hartford was like a nod to where we're from, but then also being able to connect us all as Connecticut residents. But the Live Local campaign we developed after visiting Asheville and seeing this visual branding in Asheville. Everywhere you walked, they had a consistent signage that was reminding people to love the city that you live in, and we wanted that for Hartford.
Yeah. We went to a letterpress, Ladies of Letterpress conference in Asheville, and it seemed to us that some artists had designed these posters and then gotten pretty much every store in the downtown area to put one in their windows. And they were all, they were screen printed, and they were very bold, and they said things like, local is the new black, love Asheville, shop local. And we were like, Hartford needs this. And we'd been saying that for a long time. We wanted, I mean, years ago, I lived, our sister went to school in New Orleans, and I lived down there for a little while, and they have a bumper sticker that says New Orleans, proud to call it home. And I wanted that for Hartford because growing up here, we've always sort of had this struggle of like, you tell someone you're from Hartford and they say, oh, really? You mean West Hartford? No, I mean Hartford. And I went to Hartford Public Schools, and we choose to live here, and we love it here, and we're proud of it, and other people should be too.
Well, and tell us how this shows up in the typography that you've chosen here. The letters for Live Local, Love Hartford seem as though they've almost been handmade, cut out of paper, maybe even by a child, and put down in a way that says, we're making this ourselves. That's what it says to me.
Yeah.
We're making Hartford together right now, ourselves.
Yeah, so they are, in fact, hand-cut. This was we hand-carved linoleum in order to print them. And so it's not handset type, it's not lead type or wood type, it's just simply my own hand lettering. And we made that choice so that the posters would have some visual punch to them. It would be something a little unique, but pretty simplistic and easily read from far away, and easily recognizable, so that if you saw it appear again on a T-shirt, on a bumper sticker, on a button, on a card, you'd say, oh, I've seen that before. And so that's part of the visual branding, I guess you could say.
I think you're onto something, because I think, you know, the people in Connecticut are here because they love it. And I talk to people in Hartford and Bridgeport and Georgetown, which is an old mill town where my office is, and people are very passionate about it. And I think it's hard. That doesn't always come through. And people are very proud of where they are locally. And there's just a lot of optimism and opportunity there that doesn't always come through in official pronouncements about the state.
Nikki, I'm wondering if you have any thoughts about an effort like this to create an identity almost from scratch for a place that doesn't really have it.
Yeah, I mean, Greenville, South Carolina, which is where I'm from, they have recently rebranded the entire city with this lowercase g, and the bottom, the descender of the g, makes the Reedy River, which runs through downtown, and that g is everywhere from manhole covers to sides of buildings. They've completely branded the city. And Chattanooga, Tennessee, there were some designers that designed a typeface that brands that city, all the signs and everything.
We're going to get some phone calls here at 860-275-7266. People who want to join our conversations, we talk about typography and what it means in our lives, also helping to brand and design some things that are in our environment. Meg's in Guilford. Hi, Meg. Go ahead.
Hi. It's been an interesting conversation. I wanted to thank you for it, but also say my kids are really growing up learning to read with different types. And it's helping making the whole learning to read process more fun. So I have 7-year-old twin boys that have amazing vocabularies, but they're having a hard time actually learning how to read. So there are so many apps and books available these days that really use fonts to catch kids' attention. So there's some interactive ones, like there's one called Word Wizard where, you know, you press the word once you can say it and then it does something. You know, like it moves across the screen or things like that. And so I think kids are going to be more aware of different fonts and probably able to use them in whatever they're doing, you know, like bubble writing and things like that to make things jump off the page.
That's so.
There's also a chapter books called Geronimo Stilton that Scholastic put out. And they're very funny books because he's a mouse that goes on all these adventures. And instead of just a boring chapter book with all the same fonts, each page has about 5 different words that are in different colors and different fonts. So I read the boring black font and make my boys read the bigger font that's in funny, you know, styles and things like that to try to make it achievable. So I think educators are really using fonts in different styles much more than it was ever used when, you know, I was a kid.
Well, and of course, there's so much more that's available, and I think part of it is just this idea that different things attract us at different times in our lives, and children are drawn to shapes of letters and shapes of things in a way that maybe us adults aren't anymore. I want to get to Joe quickly before our break. Hi, Joe. Go ahead. You're on Where We Live.
Hey, how you doing today?
Good. What's up?
Well, my perspective is of someone who moved here. I grew up in Jersey, went to college in New York State, and then I moved here back in 88. And what has struck me since I've been living here and I travel around, I'm a bus driver, so I'm on the road a lot, is not so much the fonts and the signage, but what really sticks with me as an outsider are the mills that are kind of nestled along all the random waterways that you see meandering throughout the towns here. So it's more a period of time that's represented in these buildings that date, you know, from the late 1700s through the 1800s to the turn of the century. So it's more that period, and it's represented more by the architecture that's surviving. And not now that I think about it so much as the signage, which is kind of, you know, contrary to what you guys are looking for. And that might be what's causing some of the problems, that it's not a signage, you know, that is displaying, hey, we are here, Sea Rock City, or the big neon signs in Vegas. It's more the sense of place.
It's the buildings that we have left, the buildings that we decided to remain up. And I know, and thank you very much for that, Alexander. This is something I know in working with older structures and newer structures, this is something you're encountering all the time.
Yeah, I think your listener makes a good point that, you know, as I mentioned, I've had a hard time sort of identifying a particular sort of signage. But when you think of sort of architecture, particularly older architecture, there is sort of a Connecticut sensibility. Or one, this isn't really about type, but one of my favorite examples is actually all the bridges over the Merritt Parkway. They were all designed by one person. There's 69 of them in the 1930s. Each one is a completely different design that reflects Art Deco, Art Moderne, different types of design from the 1930s predominantly, and that's a really striking – people don't even pay attention to it. They drive on the Merritt all the way, and I think, you know, when I think of Connecticut, I think of people in their cars on highway a lot of times, and that's one of the few opportunities where there's some kind of character, individuality, personality, and some of them have type and typography and lettering on them to be sure, but it's mostly something different.
But because of that, it is, I think from what our caller is saying too, the desire to keep that piece of architectural history in that part of Connecticut – it identifies the Merritt Parkway more closely with a kind of a 1930s America, which is different, again, than this colonial era ideal that people have for the rest of the state. Indeed, we decided that in this one little corridor, we're going to look and feel the typeface and the architectural sort of woven together in a way that tells a much different story and reminds you of a different time.
Yeah, and as long as it's true to that time and you're embracing history, I think there's nothing wrong with that whatsoever. I think when you're trying to do a modern building to make it look fake old, that's when you start to get in the weeds, and it happens with typography as well. And you can sort of honor and respect something that was done before and realizing that it might be produced using more modern technological means. I think it's fascinating because it's really easy. We as designers can use our power in creating imagery and graphics to really convey feelings and emotions. And it's like you're talking about a trustworthy typeface. So you're saying, you know, I should pick Baskerville if I want to lie to somebody because it looks like it's trustworthy. You know, I think you have to consider how you're going to use these modern and historical approaches to make sure that you're true to the nature of what you're designing.
We're going to take a break as we continue a little mini series here about design. We're talking about typography on the program with Alexander Isley, who's a designer and owner of Alexander Isley Incorporated, based in Reading. Rory and Addie Gale are here from Hartford Prints, a letterpress studio based right here in Hartford. And joining us from Cleveland today is Nikki Villagomez, who's senior designer with Dixon Hughes Goodman in Hudson, Ohio. She also writes a blog about great old signs that use typography to tell stories. She's going to be in town at the Grove in New Haven on Thursday talking about this. How do you capture or portray a brand with particular typography? That's a tweet from Derek. We'll answer that question when we come back, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up tomorrow, it's our weekly news roundtable, The Wheelhouse. We'll discuss the big story of the moment, the debate over Syria. We'll hear reactions to President Obama's national address, which is happening tonight, which you can hear tonight at 9 o'clock on WNPR. We'll also look at the latest developments regarding Syria's stockpile of chemical weapons. We really want to hear from you what you think the United States should do about Syria. That's coming up on tomorrow's Where We Live. Today, we're talking about design and typography on the program. We're joined by a group of designers, and we've got a lot of questions we still want to answer. We want to get to a few things. We just got a tweet from someone who wonders about capturing or portraying a brand with particular typography, and we'll get into this question that a lot of people want us to get to. Yahoo redesigned its logo. And from what I understand, they just kind of pulled a font off the shelf and said, this is the new Yahoo. Is that the way you do it, Alexander?
There's all kinds of ways to do it, but just, you know, people have access to designing type, but, you know, you could buy me a really expensive piano. I still don't know how to play it. And yeah. I think that the same – to me, I look at the Yahoo logo as a missed opportunity. You know, it's just really – you know, I don't know if you remember Letraset. That was this kind of rub-off lettering in the 70s and 80s before typesetting could be done at home. And it's like they put the word down. They ran out of Y's and O's and had to use the next larger size. And it's not spaced well. It's sort of – it's just plopped down there and done. I mean, past that, I don't have much to say about it. It doesn't really evoke very much. With time, people will come to associate that mark with Yahoo. But there's a real difference between just – artfully crafting letter forms and making logos and just plopping letters on a page.
Well, and I think this is one of the things that I wanted to get to, and this is in my mind, Rory, this idea that when you have a brand like United Airlines, you know what that is. It's an old company that flies you around. It's United Airlines. When you have a company that's just identified by a nonsense word, it's Yahoo, the way it visually represents itself, that word is so incredibly important, so much more important than if you have something that tells a story with the actual words. And it, you know, Alexander says it's a missed opportunity. What do you think?
Yeah, well, this is my first time seeing the new Yahoo logo, and I didn't like the old
Sweet.
One. So it's a huge, it seems like it's a huge missed opportunity to really rebrand Yahoo, and especially, you know, they need it right now, right? So if you had this fresh new brand to take it to the next level, then Yahoo could become the next, you know.
Yeah, and I mean, I think companies really should think the idea of rebranding to me is sort of insane. Like, oh, we're just going to totally reinvent ourselves because people have gotten bored with us. And yet the Yankees will never change their logo. That's classic. FedEx will never change its logo. And if they do, there should be a huge uproar about it because that they changed the colors, sure. But that little arrow, the subliminal arrow in between the letter, that's genius design right there. And so, you know, I got annoyed when Gap changed its logo. Like stop messing with me. Well, just leave it.
Dan tweets us, remember when IKEA changed their font to Verdana? You would have thought they got rid of Lingonberry Jam.
Yeah.
People actually take this stuff very seriously, right? Yeah. I mean, this is very, very important work. I just quickly get to the phones here because we've just got a couple minutes left. Veronica's in Newtown. Hi, Veronica.
Hi, thanks. I just wanted to ask regarding zoning and signage and logos and getting, I guess, permissions to create, you know, different types of signs and sizes of signs and sizes of letters, and whether if you design your logo that might be too close to someone else's well-known logo, you know, what are the ramifications of that?
I think there are a couple of issues you bring up in terms of zoning. Each municipality has its own guidelines in terms of the size of the sign, whether or not it can be neon, how close to the road it can be. Some cities, towns around here are very draconian. You can only use black and white lettering, so you might see something that be a color in one town, black and white in others. So that has to be taken up locally. And when chains come into towns, it's always an issue. And in terms of your logo or symbol looking too much like somebody else's, that's a whole other legal matter. And if you're in the same kind of industry, people have trademarks on logos that you use.
Now, you know, during our last break, somebody just mentioned the big insurance companies here in Connecticut and got me thinking, Nikki, you know, you take a look at signs all over and you're looking for visual identity for a place like Connecticut. This is it's become one of my huge pet peeves. Back in the day, a lot of the old signs that you write about, this was a small company trying to make a mark by a road sign so that you would want to come in and maybe drive into that diner or understand a little bit better about what they're selling. The new trend is big corporations put these enormous life-size signs way on top of 25-story buildings so that the skyline of any given city now has big corporate names everywhere. And it seems, Nikki, as though this is a trend in the wrong direction. It's just a homogenization of these places. And just you can have a PNC Bank building in almost any city in America now.
That's right. And it totally takes away the uniqueness of a city when that happens, you know. And I think it just goes back to bigger and better. And that's the mentality of these bigger corporations. And it's taking over the small, locally owned, locally designed typography of the area.
But of course, you also mentioned, Addie, the Citgo sign in Boston. There's one. It's a gas sign. Citgo's not a local Boston company. You might not even want to buy your gas at Citgo. But you know what? That will never change.
It'll never come down. Citgo could go out of business, and the city of Boston would, like, they'd have a huge fight on their hands if somebody tried to take that sign down. The Red Sox fans would just, like, lose it, I think.
Yeah, it's like in Long Island City, there's this big PepsiCo sign, and the bottling factory has been gone for decades, but they're actually preserved it, and they're building a whole condominium around that sign just because it's such a local landmark that's become beloved, you know? So if you leave it up long enough and it's got some character to it, people start to embrace it.
And a last thing very quickly, Alexander, we just have a couple seconds left. Thinking about the signs by the roadside, I mean, you actually have to pay attention to how you do a sign so that people can see it, read it from a distance. Standardization of these is important, isn't it?
There's a difference between regulatory traffic signs and advertising types of signs. In both cases, you need to pay attention to size of the lettering and the formulas for when you're traveling a house from a distance, how you can read it.
Like those big green signs that are on the side of the road. You want to make sure you can actually see when the exit is coming.
Right, and there's a lot of study that's been put into them. They're redesigning those signs right now. A new typeface has been developed called
We're going to have to leave it at that. There's so much more to talk about. Alexander Isley from Alexander Isley Incorporated, Rory and Addie Gale from Hartford Prints, a letterpress studio, Nikki Villagomez, who's going to be at the Grove in New Haven coming up this Thursday. She's from Dixon Hughes Goodman in Ohio. I'm John Dankosky. This is Where We Live.